is Rafalix After Hours.
Oh me, oh my, it's podcasting time once again. Rack Addict After Hours episode 132. Maybe, it probably is 132. My name is Ben. Pete is here with me, as always, of course. And we've got a special guest from a very, very long way away. He has come here all the way from a few minutes around the corner. Welcome, Caleb. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me, boys.
Awesome. This should be fun.
It's going to be a cracker.
I love it. We must start our podcast in the same way as we always do, because creature is a habit of things. Yep, let's do it. The weekly update. We'll get Pete first. What have you been doing in the past some days?
Well, I have received the Hydrosynth Deluxe.
Is it on a thing? Have you displaced the... what was it?
Access virus. Mm. Yes, I have.
It fits in the studio.
It does.
Is it as massive as you remembered?
It is very big. It's mounted above my Yamaha Motif XF8, and it's nearly as wide as that.
Yeah, because that's a beastie anyway, isn't
yeah.
it? Have you had a fiddle? Is it plugged in?
Oh, yes. I've been at it a lot.
Is it going better than the Polybrute?
Well, the Polybrute only lasted 24 hours in the studio before I returned
well
it.
At all.
No, this is a keeper.
Mm. The preset's working for you until you get stuck into the programming?
Yes, I've got my standard problem because I've got so many keyboards stacked in various locations. What tends to happen is the keyboard that I'm working on is obscured by the keyboard that's just above it.
Oh, yeah.
So I can't see the whole control surface, which is annoying, to say the least. But that's what happens when you don't have enough space.
So the new studio, of course, will be luxurious, not only in access to synths, but in general awesome visual fun.
Oh, yes. It's imperative, or it's going to get really out of hand soon.
So those are they Jasper's stands?
Yes.
Those A-frame things?
Yes.
Will you be able to arrange them a little bit more ergonomically with more space?
Well, I'm going to get more Jaspers.
Well, no. That mean everything can come out of its flight case, even the Lambda.
Well, that's the idea. I was going to have a special kind of little sort of shrine type thing for the Lander and the SH-101, as it was half my original 1980s live rig.
What was the other half again?
It was a Jupiter 4 and a Juno 60.
Good stuff. You let them go.
Alas, they're not with me anymore. They haven't been with me for 30 odd years.
Yeah. Well, Hydrosynth, excellent. That's good news. Any more from your week?
No, it's all Hydrosynth all the way.
All Hydrosynth all the time. Wonderful. Caleb, what have you been chewing on in the last 131 episodes that you haven't been here for?
Mate, so...
For all your viewers who don't know me...
Please introduce yourself.
Yeah, I'm a photographer, I'm a filmmaker, YouTuber, and I do dabble in the world of synths to some degree.
Good man.
I'm not all the way in the pool. I'm dipping my toes in. I've still got the towel around my shoulders. I haven't dove in yet, but, you know...
It's all right once you're in.
Yeah, I believe so, but I'm tiptoeing around it. So I'm still in like the plug-in world. I haven't gone to the hardware world. I used to have an old synth years and years ago. In fact, when I say old synth, how old is like 10 years ago?
It's not old.
Ah, okay. I had a really new synth. I had a Mini Nova once. I was really big in the Coldplay at the time after they released the song Midnight. And it had a vocoder on it. So I went and bought myself a Mini Nova because I saw it had a microphone attached and I went, that must have a vocoder on it. So I bought it and I sort of started dipping my toes in then.
Wonderful. We can corrupt you easily.
I'm open to being corrupted.
Good. What have you been up to? Any projects are brewing on the horizon for you?
Always. I'm so busy all the time. People tell me I'm just too busy. But the main project I'm working on at the moment is, I've come off a few tours with bands doing their content. That's what I do on the road. I take pictures, I make videos. And then, with my YouTube channel, we're just trying to churn out videos at the moment. Everything from just talking about being a creative, posting videos with interviews. I'm loving it.
Awesome. We will get back to you later because I do want to pick your brains on that corner of the world. But I must update you on my week, of course, because I went to see Pearl Jam. Oh, man. That was a thing. Amazing. Eddie Vedder sounds exactly as good as he did in the 90s. It was brilliant. It's good fun. And they played, the last song they did was Bab O'Reilly by The Who, which was came out of nowhere and it's great fun.
Now, last time I saw Pearl Jam was at a music festival in Australia.
Oh, yeah.
The same day I met Kevin Parker of Tame Impala.
Oh, no way.
But I didn't really know who Pearl Jam was. Yeah. I wasn't really into him at the time.
Yeah.
So I was standing there with like a Coke and chips just going, I'm not really sure what's going on here, but I think I'm enjoying it. Sun was setting. It was beautiful.
Nice one. It was, yeah, Hyde Park, absolutely roasting, but I did avoid sunburn. So we're all good. We are all good. Other than that, I've just been squashing a lot and finding fitness again, which is amazing fun. Now, there is synth news to chew on. Some synth news indeed. Now, we've spoken quite a few times about supply chains, people getting huge difficulties in finding their parts, and it's getting worse and worse, and it's also getting a little bit worse. So Future Retro, which, are they French? Damn, I've got to find out. No, they're not. They're from America. Future Retro, unfortunately, has bit the biscuit. 25 years of operation, they have had to throw in the towel, and it's financial and parts shortage situation, as always. Now, if you go on to Synthtopia, they actually had a pretty good wrap-up of the whole kind of issue. And with the scary headline, supply chain issues are killing synth companies and making it impossible to ship new designs. And yeah, it is a bit of a disaster. We, of course, spoke about synthesizers.com calling for investment to try and save their business. Harken Audio, who make the Continuum, have been saying they're really struggling for the DSP chips to power the Egan matrix that they put into their machines. And I think we also mentioned Isla or Isla Instruments, who had that shipment of chips that they'd been waiting on for 2 years finally arrive. And we of course also know Behringer and what they call hard vaporware, which is all of their designs that they've released in inverted commas, gone, yeah, you can buy it at some point, somewhere. We're not going to tell you when or where, but it's going to happen. So, of course, COVID has ruined things, but there's also that US tax policy thing with Chinese imported guff from 2018. That is still a problem because that is still in place under the Biden administration. But it's not good. It's not good.
I have fears that this is going to mean I'm not ever going to see an Osmos.
Oh, no. So, Caleb, to fill you in on this one, since we started this podcast, it was one of the really early episodes.
Could have been the first episode, even.
Yeah, of course, we're talking about, ooh, new releases, exciting stuff. It was, maybe we were in sort of a NAMM season or one had just happened or something, an Expressive E. Do you know the Touche, that weird kind of oblong, squishy expression controller thing?
Yeah,
so those guys, they showed their prototype instrument of, looks very keyboard, but it's got all of the, you know, pressure, the left right wiggle, the up and down, so like the Roly C boards do, but actually good and useful. And it had the synth engine, the Egan matrix that Harken Audio do,
right.
And it sounds amazing. And there's a really good demo by Cuckoo, who's actually quite a good keys guy.
I've watched some of his videos.
Yeah, and that it just sounds amazing. And the expressive possibilities for people that aren't us, that have actual piano chops, will be super cool. And we want it. We want to play with one.
But you can't get it? Is that the catch?
It's when that was, we've been doing, how long have we been doing this?
Oh, it was November 2019.
Yeah.
Oh, snap.
Yeah, and it's never been released.
Every time you go onto the website, it just says, coming soon. And you go, but when?
Yeah, but we've just, throughout this podcast, we've been checking in on it and going, ooh.
Has that
no news. It's a little bit of a meme at this point.
Has that become a weekly segment?
No, it's very rare that we get news to talk about on the Osmos front, but and then we remember about it and go, oh yeah, that would be cool if it ever turns up.
Yeah, well, fingers crossed for you, Pete.
Well,
so assuming you can, are you just going to jump on it at buy one? You think?
I would imagine so, but I mean, there's still no actual news about them actually turning up.
Yeah,
so
you would be able to use it to control your lovely Hydrosynth because it will do MIDI, whatever the thing is.
Yeah, what, the polyphonic aftertouch?
Yeah, that's the word, polyphonic aftertouch.
But it's already got a polyphonic aftertouch keybed, so.
But the Osmos one will be better.
Yes.
If smaller.
Yes, but I'm excited to use it with the engine it comes with.
Yeah, it is super cool.
Because it does the really good, the sort of Japanese plucked instrument type of sounds, but really in a way that's just thrilling.
Right. Is it almost an immersive experience rather than just a...
It's really something magical. So the synth engine is, I think you can buy it as a plug-in maybe, but it's kind of part physical modeling, part kind of VA, I think. Whatever it is, it's magical. And it works so well with those expressive controllers. I mean, it was designed for... Have you seen the Harkin Continuums?
Mm.
They are red and black. I think it's a neoprene, giant neoprene red and black rectangle.
Okay.
Obviously with the red and black being sort of the keys and it's squishy. So it's another expressive controller for keyboardists. They look quite weird.
What's it called again? Sorry?
The Harkin Continuum. Harkin is H-A-K-E-N. They're kind of cool. Anyway, we're talking about parts shortages. But yeah, no, you're right. It's annoying. And I think it's marginally worse for some of the heavy DSP stuff. I think it's getting worse anyway.
Yeah.
So yes, rest in peace, Future Retro. You had some kind of cool stuff, but you weren't really on my radar personally. But obviously they were a voice from our community. And they're going.
It's always sad, like, this pandemic, well, the past sort of 3 years, it's just killed off so many companies.
Mm.
It's sucked for, you know, on a creative's basis. Like, you're having less to choose from now because only the really formed companies and established businesses have been able to thrive because they've kind of got a bit more money in the bank to survive something like this.
Well, I'm sure there'll be more because any sort of situation like the pandemic has got a long tail to it. So
absolutely.
There will be people that are mortally wounded or businesses that are mortally wounded coming out of it, and it will take them maybe another year before they sort of completely expire. So I think we're going to see this for another couple of years, plus the fact we've still got major global problems. The supply chain thing isn't going to go away anytime soon.
No.
But there you are. We're now living in the after times, the times that came after the before times.
Okay, I'm going to save a couple of bits of news for the other half of bits and pieces. We're going to have a little break in between the synthy stuff. But here's one for you, Caleb.
Brilliant.
You with your synth plugins. You've probably got, and I'm just guessing, more than one Moog Model D type emulation option.
I probably do, actually.
Yeah, you probably do. Because I'm sure if you get one of these collections of plugins like the Native Instruments stuff, or
I've got the Arturia.
Arturia stuff. All of the other brands have just evaporated from my brain. But everyone's going to have done a Model D-ish thing at some point. What's Monarch is the Native Instruments one, I think.
So I'm not on the Native Instruments side of things. I've just got the, I think it's the V collection?
Yeah, the Arturia one.
Like the everything.
Yeah, and those are obviously vintage synth models.
Yeah, because that's my vibe. I love Juno synths. So any of that range, that is my vibe.
Awesome. Well, if we can tempt you to your classic synth bass and lead, MIDI 001. Who is this company? They call themselves Delta MIDI, and because they've stylized it with the Greek symbol, you probably can't type it in. But Delta MIDI have a very Moog Model D shaped USB controller, which I think is a cool idea. So it's just a MIDI controller with pots and switches and bits, but because it's Model D shaped and every other Model D emulation will have all the same buttons, it gives you a tactile hardware interface for potentially one of your favorite plugins. And I think that is cool and probably better than, for my use, if I was to have one, better than just having a generic controller and, ooh, I want to do some filter stuff and just mapping a knob to a cutoff or something.
It actually looks wicked.
It's pretty cool. Just extends stuff into the virtual, from the virtual into the hardware world. There it is.
Do we have a price?
Ooh, let's find out. This is the chap. Or have you looked it up already, Caleb?
I'm looking at Synth Anthony. Oh no, Synth Anatomy.
That's the chap.
And the only thing I would say about it is there's no sort of outer casing.
I just noticed that as well. Maybe they're going to plan that. But yeah,
is that an optional extra?
Who knows?
Is that Eurorack format?
Potentially, says the article. Oh no, red flag.
Kickstarter campaign. Yeah. Maybe that's why they haven't got the outer yet. They can't afford it.
Yeah, probably.
They're waiting for the Kickstarter. It's
a stretch goal. We'll put it in a case if you give us enough money. 188 euros for an early bird price, which is not terrible. 224 is probably the retail-ish. So that will be available in 17 years.
And the Behringer Model D isn't a lot more expensive than that.
That's a good point. You could... Yeah, let's find out. It's basically the same price. It's 233 squiddly boys on GAK over here. Maybe it's a less cool idea than I thought. Buy the Behringer one, because they're really good.
And they come with an outer casing,
they
right?
come with a case and everything, and real synth noises. Anyway, I think it's a cool idea. I think it is a cool idea indeed, because tactility is an excellent addition to unlock some inspiration, I firmly believe.
Totally. And it's good that companies are trying to come up with more ideas rather than just staying in the same place. Give us more of an option as a consumer.
They didn't go all the way because it is still yet another Model D related something. But
do you think they need to get a bit more imaginative?
I don't know that you can in this space, given
can
that
you
need
Model
to...
D?
Ooh, somebody did do it. Might be Studio Electronics.
It could be. The Studio Electronics do quite a lot. Or is it the other lot?
Here it is. Okay, so to answer your question, Caleb, yes, somebody has probably successfully, I think, innovated on the Model D. Let me tell you what it's called, or what they are called, because there's many of them. Okay, it will be called the Studio Electronics MIDI Mini V30. I believe the MIDI Mini reference is due to early Model Ds not having MIDI.
No, they wouldn't. They would have had MIDI at all.
Yeah. Actually, all original Model Ds.
No.
Until the Moog reissue.
Yes.
That would be the... Hence the name. Studio Electronics has been around for a long time. And this, the MIDI Mini V30, is because it's the 30th anniversary of that particular synth. They started out modding original Moog synths with MIDI, and then they just made their own cloned design, which has 3.5mm Eurorack compatibility, as well as being a sort of souped-up Model D. And it's... Is it a 4U rack mount? It's a beefy boy. It's a beefy boy. But it's still not that exciting, let's be honest. It'll still sound very similar.
Or cheap.
Oh, no, it's well over £5,000.
Wow.
It's mad. It's huge. Hugely expensive.
If you didn't have a Model D, would you consider that a reasonable sort of maybe upgrade? Is it worth the over £5,000 to not have just a...
Let's check Reverb for the prices of the old Moog reissue, because that's not available anymore. Let's see what it is. Place your bets, guys. This will be... What was that from? 4 years ago? 5 years ago?
Yeah, about
they
that.
They reissued it?
About that time.
How much were they retailing at the time? Do you
3,300.
I'm going to say...
Got good memory for it.
I'm going to say 5.5K.
Yeah, I think they're going to be up there. About 4.5. 4.5, 5.
Let's do... I'll do the old sold listings only, so we can have a look. All filters. Sold listings on Reverb. Cheapest I've seen, 4,890. And for some reason, why is that one? Oh, this is the Walnut edition, which actually didn't look much different. 7,924. Another Walnut edition for 8,997.
And these are all reissues?
All reissues. Let's have a look. Original.
I'm kicking myself again. First, it was the reissue of the 2600 that I should have bought.
Yeah, the big one.
Yeah, and now I've realised in hindsight I should have bought one of the Model Ds and left it in its box.
You can... There was one... This is another... Oh, no, these aren't sold listings. Let me have a look. I was just going to say there's one on Reverb at the moment, an original one from the 70s, 8,804. So you might as well just buy an... Although, would the original still work that well? I don't...
Well, this becomes a toss-up, doesn't it? Is it worth buying the original one maybe for just the mojo factor, or should you get a more current one, or should I say a more recent one?
Well, you still won't have a warranty on either now, so that's not an argument.
But the new one is going to be a lot more stable, a lot more reliable. A 50-year-old Model D.
Yeah.
It depends whether you're just a collector or you're seriously trying to make music and want something that's going to be reliable and stable in the studio.
No, that's absolutely fair.
Yeah, so sold original ones, we got 7,487 and 8,671. Though there is one that went for over 13,000. I don't know why. Anyway, yeah, no, I would want a newer one. It'd make me feel a bit better, just in case, given you're splashing 8 big ones on it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
At least if a part went on it, surely that's a lot easier to get.
Yeah, I'm not sure how much kind of new old stock or... out of production parts you'd have to worry about on a synth like this. What do you know?
Well,
about this
the bit? Reissue would have modern components just for a whole variety of reasons.
Yeah.
Mainly for reliability, as we see with the Prophet 5.
Yes, yes, indeed.
In fact, we opened one up.
Oh, you did?
Last week.
Oh, damn, wish I was there.
We had a Prophet 10 with a rattle.
Oh, no.
Something was shifting around inside, and they were going to send it back for repair. And I thought, no, let's just crack the thing open and have a look and see what's moving around. So, as I predicted, when you go open it up, there's nothing in there. There's just little circuit board on the floor of the synth. And this...
And as one it was, for the panel, and that's it.
Yeah, and as it was a Prophet 10, it had a second daughter board above it.
Just more voices.
With more voices on it.
Wow.
But We found a little, like a little oblong weight with plastic around it, and we couldn't work out where it came from. So we're thinking it was something that was utilised during the fabrication process.
Just left it in there.
It fell inside and stayed in there because the synth checks out in every way. So
take that, launch it.
Crisis averted.
Put it back together.
Yeah. Right. Let's take a break from the synthy stuff to talk to the man opposite me at the moment. So, Caleb, how come you went from bass man in a music shop to photography, videographer, editor extraordinaire, YouTube personality, interviewer of local bands?
Yeah.
Where? How? Why?
You know what? It wasn't as quick and sudden as it probably looks on the surface.
Yeah, it looks to me suddenly. Ooh,
yeah.
Caleb Hartley invited you to like his Facebook page. Ooh, there's some good stuff here.
Yeah.
What? Where did this come from?
So this actually goes back to when I was probably a late teenager. So before I moved over to England.
Yeah.
And I was really into a guy called Casey Neistat.
Of course.
But
we
on
know
the
him
low
well.
Key. On the low key.
Well, you mean you were absolutely obsessed but just didn't tell anybody?
Yeah, exactly. And so on one of my first trips back to Australia when I was visiting, I bought myself a little camera and I did a few vlogs and I did post them, but I got rid of them because looking back, they make me die inside.
They're just private on YouTube now.
That's
it. Do you actually go full on and delete
them?
Oh, no,
I deleted them. The only person who probably has it is a random guy at YouTube who works in the database. He probably looks at it every day and laughs.
Yeah.
But it's, so I did that for a while and I never showed anyone. So in my head, I was like, I'm the music guy. I play bass.
Right.
I can't do film and photography as well. Like, you pick one or the other. You can't be like two creatives, right? And so I put it on the back burner for a while and moved over here, was doing the music thing, was with the band and devoted myself to that. But all throughout that, I'd be at shows and I'd see photographers shoot and I'd be like, that does look good, doesn't it? It does look like fun. And I did that for a while. And it wasn't until going back to, when would it have been, 2018. So at the time, I was going through a really rough stage with my depression. So that's something I've always struggled with. And one of my old friends from Australia that I'd known since, gosh, I was about 10. She came over for a European trip and we decided we'd go to Paris because I'd never been myself. I thought, why not, 3 days away? Keeping in mind, because I was really depressed at the time, on this trip, she'd actually bought this really good camera to take pictures of her trip, obviously. And when we were in Paris, like, oh, do you want me to take some photos for you while we're on this trip? And, you know, you go off and do your thing and I'll just capture the moments for you. Because I didn't feel like doing anything else. And for some reason, that trip was really, really special to me because I suddenly found a purpose holding a camera. It was really cool because what I ended up doing was the first few shots came through and you go, oh man, I took that? That's wicked.
Ooh, it's actually working.
Yeah. Love it. And then next thing you know, it was the first time in like months I'd felt an excitement and I realized there's a purpose with holding a camera. Now, I spoke about it in one of my recent YouTube videos where the hotel we were staying in had this old iMac computer.
Oh yeah.
And because I couldn't sleep, I'd go down and I was up there till like 2 a.m. every night, just me and the hotel receptionist looking over my shoulder, watching me edit these pictures on like some really, really like awful editing software. And I remember on the second night was pivotal because there was this picture I took of the Eiffel Tower, which looking back is okay shot. It's nothing like world beating. I remember looking at that and just feeling like inspired again.
Yeah.
You know, like in a Disney movie where the character has like all these little fairy lights flying about them.
Yeah.
That's how I envisaged I probably looked.
With stirring soundtrack, the camera's spinning around them, slowly panning away and they're sort of...
That's it, they're lighting up.
Yeah.
That's exactly what it felt like for me. And after that, I kind of went, oh, well, that's really cool. Put it on the back burner because I was depressed again. And then moved forward a few years into the... Are we allowed to say COVID on this podcast without it being cancelled? Yeah, sound. So I got COVID in August last year.
Mm.
And that knocked me about so bad that I literally had 10 days of just like lying there, pretty much doing what I was doing when I was depressed, but I was really like physically sick this time.
Right, yeah.
But within that, I was able to kind of ask myself, like, you know, what I really want to do once I've done this. It felt like a kind of fork in the road moment in my life for some reason. And I was like, well, why don't I just buy a really good camera? And so I did that. And ever since, I was like, this is killer. Like, I'm enjoying it. And I feel as inspired taking photos and making films as I did playing music. And even more so, I still get the same rush from shooting a show as I do playing one.
Oh, that's cool.
To the point where for the past few months, I've been weighing up going, well, to either really love photography... And I never really loved music as much as I thought because I could feel the balance moving.
Ooh,
and that
pivotal moment.
Yeah, because it also became an identity crisis as well because for so long...
I'm identifying with so many things here.
But like music was who I was. Like being the bass player was who I was. Working in a guitar shop selling basses was who I was.
Yeah.
And suddenly, out of not really nowhere, but it's crept up from the cave I put it in, photography and film and making videos was really starting to shift that balance and having more priority in my life, to the point that I started to grow my photography business, to the point where within a year, I could go full-time. I'm still scared. Go part-time.
Yeah.
I'm not full-time yet. That's probably...
Either way, freelance is terrifying.
Yeah. But so I never had that, because with doing music, I think you have less control over how successful your project can be. There's a lot more gatekeepers within that world, where with photography, people can just look at your picture and go, I'm going to hire you.
No one
really looks at your band and goes, I'm going to offer you a gig on the sort of consistent basis that you get with people messaging me going, hey, can we do a shoot? And that was kind of the point where I went, I could actually do something with this. I love it. I love doing this. I love doing this as much as I love doing music. Well, why don't I just try that? And so I've just been pushing into that world. And
that is an awesome story. Thank you so much for sharing. That's brilliant.
Yeah, it's I wouldn't change anything with how much I spent on the music. The thing I do different is chase both inspirations at the same time with the same intensity. Because I think you can do that. It's just you got to be careful not to burn out. Because I'm a VIP, like an MVP, sorry, at burning out. I'm very important at burning out. And I'm also the most valuable player when it comes to burning out. I'm really good at it. That's all I can say. I can run 100 miles an hour at something. The one thing I haven't learned yet that I need to, if I'm going to become part-time freelancer or a full-time freelancer, is that work-life balance.
Totally.
And it probably comes from the fact that I still have a full-time job.
Yeah.
In quite an intense environment that takes up 9 hours of my day just being there, plus traveling to and from. You go home and then you're trying to do, at this point, part-time hours running your own business.
When actually you just want to eat and go to bed.
Yeah, absolutely. I've got Love Island to watch, you know.
Disappointed.
I find, to be fair, watching Love Island's like a reminder that I'm not an awful person. That's what it is. It's just sort of a morality check. It's just like, I've got my girlfriend and my dog here. Would I be like him? I don't think so. Cool.
Brilliant. Okay, we are a techie podcast. We're a big bunch of nerds here.
Perfect.
But we do like our video and our cameras. Pete's a bit of a camera whore, to be honest, sometimes.
Yeah.
Let's talk the techie stuff. This magical camera that has unlocked so much for you.
Yeah.
What did you get? What lenses are you running?
Mate, so I'm sure you guys do it with synths as well.
Oh, yeah.
But I was watching so many reviews and trying to weigh out the pros and cons of...
I've been there.
...whole world of cameras. I ended up settling on a Sony A6600. Now, it was a toss-up between the A7 series and the A6000 series. Yeah. But I went for the 6600 purely because I knew I probably want to do more video at some point, doing the YouTube thing, doing the interviews, just making short films. And at the time, the A7 I was looking at, or
it
that
would have been
range,
before the third series of them had turned up.
Yeah, probably. They only had like a 10-minute record time in 4K, and I wanted to record everything in 4K, and I didn't know how long my videos would be.
Right.
So I decided, well, I better get the A6600 because it had no time limit. It was the right decision for me, even though it was an AP, it was a crop sensor camera. It was the better option because I've done a few interviews where I've had it recording for like 25 minutes.
Yeah.
4K, you pick it up and it's like a bit hot. You're like, shouldn't have done that. Oh dear.
Yeah.
But if I had the A7, I've had to stop halfway through, which breaks the flow.
I learned quite a while ago, apparently, a lot of those record limits are actually for tax reasons.
Really?
Yeah.
There goes the stomach again.
There's a 29/30-minute limit, and I think it's a European Union thing. So if it's classified as a stills camera, it can film no longer than 29 minutes. And if it needs to film longer, it needs to be classified as a video camera.
Yeah,
and then there's a sort of tax bracket or something.
They really can't with the tax for everything, don't they?
It's pretty stupid. I think there's softwares or something. You can like put different firmwares on them to get around it on some of the older Sony stuff.
But you've got to watch out that you don't fry your CPU.
Yeah.
Well, that's it. And you can't even use like different third-party batteries, because some of the Sony cameras will pick up and be like, you sure you want to use this? And then you're going to be like, yeah.
The one we use here, it just refuses to read out the how much battery percentage you've got on some on the third-party ones. So it's really dicey.
It gets passive-aggressive.
Am I going to make this shot? It's really annoying. Lenses. Let's talk lenses.
I love Sigma. Sigma awesome. Lens. So when I was first getting into it, obviously I didn't have a massive budget. And I fell on the Sigma lenses because their cross-sensor lenses are mint. So I'm using the 18-50, one that they brought out about 6 months ago. Perfect. Beautiful. It's pretty much my stays on camera lens.
Yeah.
Like if I'm shooting a show, because mirrorless is so small and it's my run and go, if I'm chucking on a gimbal and I'm running with that, everything is just, it's just perfect for what I need. I do have one of the 30mm 1.4s prime lens.
Yeah.
That looks really good.
Nice.
And that was the first lens I bought, which Because
yeah,
at
no,
the
that's
time,
an interesting choice.
Well, at the time, they didn't have the 18 to 50,
yeah.
Which I would have got straight away. That would be my first choice lens. But I decided to go for the 30, and it looks really good for portraits. But then again, you can use anything you want for portraits.
Of course you can.
50s or 85s or...
Macro lens, just walk a long way away.
Yeah, you could do that. Zoom from a 700. No, yeah. But that's the thing. And I mean, it's like using a synth as well. You've got to find the right tools that work for what you're trying to create.
You can work around the limitations that you have and you'll end up with a different product.
Absolutely.
Based on what you were using.
Absolutely. And, you know, you could go... I know a lot of people who have gone out and bought like the best of, you know, either music gear or camera gear. But if the quality of the work you're not creating doesn't kind of add up to that, then what's the point of just buying something because apparently it's the best?
Yeah. In this sort of techie world, it's so difficult. Well, especially for me anyway, getting sucked into actually... I was thinking about this with guitar. Last episode I was talking about I've been playing guitar a bit more. I've owned Fractal Audio stuff in the past, just the best of the best, depending on who you ask. And at the moment I'm using Neural DSP and bits. And I was thinking, I got some cash. Could get the little HX Line 6 Heat, the little baby one.
They're great.
And then I thought... But it's not the best option. Maybe I'll get a quad cortex. No, Ben, don't do it, you absolute moron. You're happy with, and I'm making good noises with the stuff that I have.
That's
a really difficult battle in so many fields.
But do you find, I mean, I find as a creative that you've got to walk that line where you need good quality gear to one be reliable, to one sound good or look good. But sometimes you don't need all the features that one of these top of the line pedals have.
No, yeah, absolutely don't. And I never see it. I think, but I want it so desperately.
I might use that feature one day.
Yeah,
I don't know what for, but I might use it. Do you get that with synths a lot?
Yeah, definitely. So one of the bits that I think really derailed my modular journey towards the end was focusing on, oh, but actually it would be really cool to do this with the modular rather than going, this one particular thing is hilarious fun, even if whatever noise it makes isn't actually that practical. I have fun using it. I should have focused on this is fun rather than I want to make a self-contained live system Groovebox Matron that can do absolutely anything ever.
That's
to be fair, I did do that,
but
I didn't actually make any music with it, really.
That's... All right, so we're talking about a balance between what's fun and what's practical.
Yeah, none of this was, of course, a business context for what I was doing,
so
it didn't matter. And subsequently, my enjoyment of synthesizers vanished.
That's a fair point. You can have fun with your business.
Mm.
Especially as a creative. Being creative is fun, right?
Yeah.
So if you're just getting the practical side of things, like, sure, I can just buy lenses because they'll be practical, or I should just buy certain cameras because they'd be practical and it's got the best specs. I actually have fun with my little run and go.
Yeah.
So if I was using gear that was actually a chore, then I think my job would become a chore rather than, oh, I really enjoy doing this.
Yeah.
Like, how wonderful is it to wake up and go, like, when I go to a shoot and I'm going, I love doing this and I'm getting paid for it as well. Like, this is sick. I don't love my day job.
It pays the bills.
It pays the bills, but so can photography.
Yeah.
What do you think, Pete?
I would totally agree. Once you start doing it as you are in a kind of professional context, you, I would imagine, start optimizing the equipment anyway. It's all about practicality. Weight, how can I lug this stuff around? How can I get it up and running quickly as possible?
Totally.
You know, I don't want to be faffing around. Time compresses when you're in a high-pressure situation and
agreed.
You need things to sort of fall into place, not be befuddled by functionality or something like that.
Well, that's it. One of the first questions I asked myself when I was buying this gear was, what do I need right now to get started? Like, do I need all the best gear? No. Partly because I couldn't afford all the best gear at the time, but I didn't need it to get started. And that's rung true because I've been able to get work just by using the gear I've got. In fact, I think the gear you have is less important than the quality of work you put out.
Of course.
Absolutely.
Again, back to the balance of good gear can help you get good results, but also I think good talent will help you get great results.
Absolutely.
Well, just enthusiasm will get you quite far, to be honest.
Yeah.
Yeah, even if you absolutely suck right at the beginning, if you're enthusiastic, you can't help but learn and get better because you'll just keep doing it, and by practicing, you improve.
Well, that's actually what I've loved about getting deeper into photography and filmmaking. Like with music, I never learned any musical theory out of will because it just bored me to death.
Yeah.
I could think of nothing worse than going, well, what's a circle of fists? Why is that important to me? Bored me to to sleep. Whereas with photography, I'm like, okay, why does this relate to each other? And what's the science behind lighting?
Yeah.
What does that 5,600K of light, what does that do? Why is that important to me? That science actually is interesting to me now. And I wish I had that with music growing up.
Yeah.
Whereas this is why I think synths are kind of interesting, because there's a lot of science behind it.
That's absolutely why I was attracted to them at the start, is here's quite an interesting technical thing that also happens to be a musical tool. I was always more interested in the technical part of stuff. That's why I wanted to be a studio engineer, not a producer.
Ooh, good parallel. Yeah.
I do have this sneaking feeling that sometimes I prefer the rigging up or connecting or making things work side of the studio than actually the making music side of it, possibly, which...
Like Lego.
Yeah. It gives me sort of all sorts of conflicted guilt about it that I have to sort of somehow rationalise and get through.
I think we were talking about this with Telmo, actually, when we were talking about synthesizers.com going down. So they still make, or a bit, anyway, whatever, Moog format modular, which is quarter-inch jack cables. And we're talking about the simple pleasure of plugging one of those in.
That click when it goes in.
Compared to the 3.5mm stuff that we use for our modular bits.
It's like a bit of a pop.
Just the simple satisfaction of using nice equipment.
Companies really need to play into that.
Yeah.
They need to work on their click game, don't they?
There are definitely people that do, like UDO.
Right.
The guy behind the Super 6, I've totally forgotten his name, very nice chap, but he's so particular about the quality of the potentiometers that will last forever and feel good with the precise amount of resistance that he wants, and those clickety buttons that you get on like the Prophet 6 and things, and he really enjoys the tactility and reliability of things. It's something Pete and I talk about quite a lot, which we've still not managed to eloquently sum up, which is this immense satisfaction from well-made objects that feel good and are excellent in their operation and are probably handcrafted in some way. Just artisanal things.
Perfect form and fit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, do you reckon you could sum it up by pretty much saying you get satisfaction out of using this gear because it's a full package to you?
It is, in every possible
way. Sounds good, it feels good to use. Because that's another thing, like with my camera, it feels good for me to use, but I know my way around it, it makes sense to me, all the knobs and buttons.
A nice ergonomic quality to it.
Exactly.
The only bit of gear that I can think of that was relatively expensive and is a completely guilt-free purchase because of its amazing utility and quality is this microphone, and probably the Fethead that I use with it.
Oh, aye.
Because, I mean, we've used it so much. Obviously not in the early days of this podcast because I didn't have it, but I've put so many words through it, it's absolutely paid for itself, and it just makes me happy.
What's your word count, do you reckon, through
absolutely
this mic?
Absolutely no idea. couldn't tell you. If it's in the millions, I'll be happy. Anyway, it's been amazing talking to you. And thank you so much for coming and chipping in.
Thanks for having
me. This is a great old COD past. And it's not over yet. We still have some synths to talk about. Two West Coast things. Tip Top Audio. And of course, their collaboration with Buchla. They have more of the range arriving. Let me put this into a position where I can read it and get the optimum tone. So, we have the Model 245T sequential voltage source and the dual voltage processor, which is 257T. So, these are quite classic in the Buchla world, especially the sequential voltage source, because it is a four-row, five-step sequencer, which is a little bit wonky and strange. But I think, to be honest, I haven't watched too much of the Tip Top Buchla stuff, but I believe it's been very well received and, of course, is unreasonably cheap in comparison to the real thing. So it's not a Behringer situation, Caleb. It's brilliant. There, Tip Top Audio is an established, quality, awesome manufacturer full of great people, and they've actually collaborated with Buchla to bring these to life. So it's not super budget. It's going to explode in 4 seconds. But actually, let me see if I can find a comparison. So, sequential voltage source. Okay, the current version, which is the 251E Buchla Quad Sequential Voltage Source, is a digital version of that, so you have up to 50 steps per channel, and it's kind of got menus and a bit of clickety-clackety, but that's the modern equivalent of it, is... Pete, you have a flavour for Buchla prices. Do you want to put a guess in this?
And this is the Tip Top Audio?
Starting with the currently available one from Buchla, and only from KMR in the UK.
2,500.
1,600. But still, that's a single module for a modular synth that will do nothing on its own. And you need to put it in a very expensive powered case. And Tip Top Audio will be giving it to us for, I'm sure, under £200 or £250. Let's see if we've got prices on here.
Is that a common practice in the modular world?
Not really.
Okay.
So you could, on certain occasions, buy modular from Moog. They sort of reissued certain historic modular things, and they were tens of thousands of pounds.
Oh, boy.
And Buchler is very much in the same way. So this West Coast, East Coast thing came about from Moog on the East Coast in North Carolina,
sure,
and then Buchler on the West Coast somewhere in California. It is California, wasn't it?
Yeah.
I'm
thinking San Francisco for some reason, but I could be wrong.
I'm not sure. Anyway, price TBD, but a similar sized and capable module is $210 from Tip Top Audio. So, so much cheaper, so much cheaper.
Yeah.
And they sound amazing, and they look great. Tip Top Audio, the good guys. Right, so that's cool. We've got more of that on the way. Finally, a company that you know, Pete, ST Modular, because you bought their mixer, one of the mixer options.
Yes,
fact.
I did.
Well, there is a new DIY full synth on the way from them, and it is West Coast in flavor. Let me read you the headlines. You've got, of course, your dual oscillator wave-forming mixing folding situation. So you have in your primary oscillator five waveforms and noise with pulse width modulation, linear and exponential FM and wave shaping with two selectable sub-octaves. Secondary oscillator has wave shaping with five waveforms and an EQ, which is cool, on a single shape control. Two CV controllable wave folders and sync as well, as similar features to the other one. You have two sequencers, which I need to find the details on somewhere else on this webpage. Where are you hiding? Yes, so you have a five-step trigger and CV sequencer and an extra four-step CV sequencer. And it's nice having that odd step count for some weird wonkiness. You have dual low-pass gates, VCAs, and ADSRs, as well as a function generator inspired by the 281E from Buchler and a built-in reverb. And it's DIY, and it's called Euphoria, and I'm very interested in it because I love DIY stuff. Okay, we got some fun specs here. So about €600 in total cost, which isn't too unreasonable. 16 PCBs. There's one primary one, and then all the other modules are kind of stacked on top of it. Do you want to place a bet on how many individual parts there are to be soldered or mounted to this machine?
400.
Ooh, it's a long way off. 1,680. But I was thinking about this because you've got the TTSH.
Yes, I
have.
Sitting,
and it has been sitting for a long time.
I'm almost considering selling it.
Oh no! But kits like that for big machines, for classic replicas, are really pricey a lot of the time.
Yes.
Estimated total costs for the full DIY build, I don't know if we'll be offering complete kits or just PCBs, €600, I think, is a really cool deal for a full DIY synth build.
Does it come with a case, or is it just the faceplate? Or
I think it's going to be Euro-rackable. In the pictures, there is, you can kind of see it, there's a nice wooden case. Might be an optional extra or something, because I'm sure it'd be
easy to make. Does look quite impressive,
own.
Though. Is it a conglomeration of all their kits?
I don't think so. I think, obviously, there's lots of multifarious kits available from ST Modular, and he's probably built on his experience doing all of those. And there may well be some overlap, but I think a lot of it is quite fresh. Yeah, so there's a reverb in there. There's sort of outputs with headphones and such. It's pretty cool. There is also this Variboard thing, which, what does it say? Variboards are interchangeable boards, each offering a different functionality. Who knows? It could be anything, really. I don't know if it means you can choose a particular variant of the kit and solder something different so it'll do something else. Either way, keep an eye on it. ST Modular Euphoria. And with that, we come to the end. Our final segment, the miscellaneous multimedia recommendation, of course. Caleb,
yeah.
Do you want to go first?
I will go first.
You've got a media of the multifarious option.
I've
like the word multifarious today,
yeah,
it seems.
I brought it along, which almost seems impractical for a show and tell on a podcast. I can only do 50% of that. Is that all right?
That's fine. We
do
it a lot of the time. So our audience just hears Pete and I going, ooh, yeah, ooh, that feels amazing. And that's not an innuendo at all. That's probably when Pete handed me his hammer, which is also not an innuendo, but that was quite an extraordinary artisanal hammer. And
artisanal
that
hammer.
Camera from a couple of episodes ago that you found in the photography. Anyway, we do show and tells quite a bit.
Oh, wicked.
So we just tell and tell. Tell it really well.
Tell it really well.
And then the audience, with only their ears to use, will probably get it.
Well, just for an example, I have brought along a book. My favourite book at the moment.
I love that one.
That's really ASMR, right? So I don't read a lot of books, right? Let me preface this. I never grew up loving reading, so I've probably read like 5 books in my life.
That's not a lot of books. Like,
no, it's not. I mean, maybe 1984, George Orwell, The Scarlet Pimpernel by whoever
it is
wrote that.
We know the one.
A lot of these were forced on me in English class.
Yeah.
I think I've read Wuthering Heights.
Mm.
Although
was that by choice?
No, that was English class. And while I say I think I read it, I think I know what happened, but it might be because of Kate Bush.
You might have. Oh, right. You might have been
there. I might know the dance more than I know what actually happened in the book.
Right.
And the other one would probably be Where's Wally and then Clifford the Big Red Dog. So I don't really know if anyone who's a real intellectual reader is going to vibe this. But this year, actually, end of last year, I got into this book, Atomic Habits by a guy called James Clear. And this was a pretty life-changing book because I've always looked at just the bigger picture, like my entire life, how do I go about that, rather than breaking down into little bits. And this book was really good for me because it was talking about atomic habits, the smaller habits we get into, and really breaking that down and breaking it down to what are the purposes of those smaller habits? How much can I change my life by implementing those habits? And obviously, it's a lot harder than just going, well, I'm going to have this routine now. You've got to work on it. And this book was really good in working me through that. So, yeah, as it says, an easy and proven way to build good habits and break bad ones. And I'm about halfway through. And yeah, it's a book that's been able to hold my focus, and it's not one I've just put on the back shelf.
So maybe he's going to become a bit of a bookworm soon.
Maybe. It's not that I can read fine. It's just I find it really, it's a chore for me to actually sit down and make time.
Yeah,
ironically,
no, you do have to make time.
I need to make it a habit,
yeah.
Which this book has helped me with. But it is, for me, sitting down to read, I'd rather be like out making videos or taking pictures.
Yeah.
But it is good to just sit down and relax for a bit.
Yeah. I've got a little way into it myself. It's definitely a good one.
Super good. Also want to read, I don't know if you guys have come across it, but the Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck.
I'm also into that one.
Is
but
it good?
I still haven't finished it.
Okay.
Not sure yet, but I'll let you know.
Because I know
if
a lot
I get
of people
into
rave
it.
About it.
Yeah, there's another one, the Chimp Paradox.
Okay.
Which is more of a motivation thing.
Sure.
And avoiding instant gratification and procrastination and things.
Oh dear, I think I might need to read that.
Yeah, I needed to, but it sounds so stupid. I hate monkeys. And the fact that the book is called The Chimp Paradox, and it's referenced throughout the entire book, of course, just really annoyed me. So I found it a struggle.
Why do you hate chimps?
I don't know. I think they're disgusting.
Really?
Yeah, it's just one of those irrational things.
Pete, do you have an animal you hate?
I can't think of one.
Straight out of left field, Ben hates primates.
All of them.
All of them. All universally, of them. They are the worst.
Well, all monkeys, yep. And apes, the whole...
Well, when you're a kid and you go to the zoo, right, and your parents are like, ooh, what's your favourite animal? And loads of people, because you do school trips, stuff like that, loads of people, I want to go see the monkeys. And like, please take me to the reptile house. I hate monkeys. I want to see frogs or snakes or something.
Imagine you on Noah's Ark just seeing the monkeys come from a distance. Nah, lock the door.
Kick the plank off. They're not going.
So, but you'll make exceptions for humans.
Yes. I mean, I'm not a big fan of many humans, to be honest. I don't have a wide social circle. Anyway, Atomic Habits.
Atomic Habits.
Great.
Great book. Tiny changes, remarkable results.
Awesome.
Go for it.
Awesome. I will have a quick one, which is just some music to recommend. I can't remember if I've done this one yet. I've definitely spoken about individual songs, but the whole album, Everything Everything's Raw Data Feel, I bought the CD, it's in the car, and it's just such a jam. It's such a jam. Do you Everything Everything, Caleb?
I've nothinged at this point.
Nothing. You should. It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
There is quite a lot, and this is so far unproven. I need to do a bit of research. I feel like there's a lot of modular on this album, not only because the first track is called Teletype, like the monome or monome module, but there is a track called Cut Up, opens with some pretty modular sounding stuff, and I want to know. But yeah, it's great. So I think early favourites were Bad Friday, Pizza Boy. Current favourites are Cut Up and My Computer. But yeah, get the whole album in you, and then I won't mention it again. Pete, it's time for your micro segment called What Have You Found on YouTube This Time? Maybe less exasperated. What have you found on YouTube this time?
Well, this time I have found quite a geeky channel.
That's how we like it.
Get your geeky hats and t-shirts on for this one. Anyway, the channel is entitled Asianometry.
Mm.
So the description says video essays on business, economics and history, sometimes about Asia, but not always.
That's quite specific. Sometimes, but not always.
So the one particular video essay that caught my attention and led me to look at a few more was a really good in-depth explanation to the semiconductor shortage.
Oh, cool.
Which wasn't how I perceived it at all. Apparently, the problem is it's not all semiconductors. It's mainly what they call trailing edge semiconductors.
Excellent. I have absolutely no idea what one of those is.
Well,
do tell us.
Obviously, you can imagine the latest semiconductors, the latest Apple chips, whatever they are, et cetera, are leading edge.
Mm.
Trailing edge are semiconductors that are still used extensively in manufacturing, but they could be quite old, effectively. And when they do get old, two factors come into play. One, because semiconductors are traded like a commodity, their actual value is very low.
Mm.
And also, the fab plants that make them are also old, and although they've paid for themselves as such, they still have to be maintained. And typically, the machines aren't made anymore.
Maintenance gets more expensive.
And they have to cannibalize machines to get other machines working, so there's less production capability. And because there's no profit in there, the emphasis or the enthusiasm that chip manufacturers have about producing these chips, although they're very much in demand, is much less. So consequently, we have a semiconductor shortage, and this is something that predates the pandemic for possibly a good decade or so.
Right. So I mean, it'll be part of the reason you had rafts of Ford cars with nothing working because they needed sort of slightly older chips.
Well, typically, car manufacturers want to go to tried and tested technology. They don't want some leading-edge chip that's going to do something really strange. So it's all about reliability. So some piece of technology that's maybe been produced for maybe, I don't know, 30 years is their preference.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a good channel if you were possibly looking for a starting point and you're doing a bachelor's degree or something in computer science or something like that. But there are several other interesting explanations for technical circumstances, sometimes technical, sometimes economic, and there's a few other bits and pieces. But generally, you know, if you're interested in those sort of things, I would recommend it. So that's Asianometry on YouTube.
Lovely stuff. Well, audience, it's been a pleasure for you, I'm sure, because it's definitely been a pleasure for me. Thank you, Caleb, for coming along to our little music and technology podcast. I believe you're going to be starting your own very soon.
I will. Maybe we could swing around the other way. You boys come see me.
I think so. And we'll absolutely be giving you a shout out as soon as it's available on the airwaves. Thank you so much. We'll catch you in the next one. Farewell.